There's no shortage of entertainment in downtown Alton, especially when it comes to bars and taverns. As anyone who has stumbled along the sidewalk downtown late on a Saturday night can tell you, you can find all kinds of places to get a drink. Wine bars, martini bars, dive bars, Irish pubs, you name it. Alton has had a long history with booze, dating back to the very start of the town. One of the first establishments that opened for business in Alton back when Rufus Easton was still laying out the place was a tavern. And sure, taverns were a little different back then and were more of an inn than a saloon, but hey, they still had liquor on hand. The Alton Riverfront, with its travelers, steamboat crewmen, and quarry workers, all who loved brawling and drinking contests and were always thirsty, well, they always had saloons offering something to quench that thirst. In the 19th century, downtown Alton was also home to several quality brewers who supplied the city with beer. In the early days, most beer was shipped to town from St. Louis, but by the 1830s, it was decided we needed a brewery of our own. The first was started by Philip Yackel, who also opened a saloon on 5th Street. He and his partners founded the Union Brewery. There was also the Killian Brothers Ale Brewery in 1845 and the Alton Brewery a short time later. It had a brewery and a malt house on the old Plank Road. After that, there was the Western Brewery and then the Cooper Brewery, which opened just before the Civil War. In February 1862, a boiler exploded there and the blast was heard for a mile in every direction. Only Richard Cooper was near the boiler when it blew up, but he was sheltered from flying debris by two empty beer kegs. The most famous of the Alton breweries, Bluff City, was started by William Netzhammer in 1883. He originally lagered the German-style beer he made in caves located under the city before investing in ice-making facilities in 1890. Bluff City was later purchased by Anton Reck, and he created a rivalry with the town's only other major brewer, the Alton Brewery, until Prohibition crippled them both. Bluff City would survive those tough times by selling ice, but the Alton Brewery was shut down for good. Bluff City thrived in the years that followed, quenching the thirst of Alton residents for a couple more decades. The company grew during the 1930s and added several special brews, including one only sold at Christmas time. Many of the labels from the 1930s listed the main ingredient of the beer as Alton Lake Water, which is curious since there's no lake in town, but maybe that sounded better than water from the Mississippi River, which was actually its main ingredient. Bluff City struggled through the shortages caused by World War II, and by 1951, existed on paper only. No more beer was being made at the factory at Pearl and Union Streets. Today, the name is still with us, but the beer, well, it's a thing of the past. As I mentioned, Alton has had a long history with booze, and it's always been a thirsty place. Even during Prohibition, that ill-conceived law that banned booze and liquor across the country, well, Alton was considered a lost cause. The mayor at the time, Stephen Crawford, did make an honest effort to uphold the law, despite the lack of interest from the public and the police. He forced law enforcement officials to raid local bootlegging operations and speakeasies, but the makers and sellers of illegal hooch were usually out of jail within a day or two. Prohibition was no more popular in Alton than anywhere else in the United States, although the Mississippi River did provide some bootleggers with a novel approach for getting their wares to the public. Many of them would cruise up and down the river, selling liquor from a boat, always staying out of the jurisdiction of local police departments. So I think we can say there are two things that Alton loves: booze and ghosts. And in this special episode, we'll introduce you to a couple of places, well, that just may have both. Welcome to a special On the Side podcast from American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to bringing you the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of our hometown, Alton, Illinois. Yes, we are back home again, and this is episode 6 of an offshoot of the regular podcast, going back to our very beginning with updates and a lot of new stories from season 1 of the show, which delved into the history and mystery of Alton. And why return to season one? Well, for one thing, the sound was terrible back then, and we also ended up leaving a lot of things out, which was completely my fault. So last year, after doing a lot of additional research, I published a new edition of Haunted Alton, and we wanted to bring some of that material here so that Cody and I could revisit some old stories, offer some updates, and bring you some brand new tales from one of the most haunted small towns in America, Alton, Illinois. One of the largest drinking establishments in downtown Alton, and definitely one of the busiest, is Max Time Out, a sprawling, multi-level, multi-bar food and drinking spot that's thrived for years along Bell Street. But Max was not the first building located on that spot. The first was the Mercantile Building, which was constructed back in the 1850s. Over the decades, it was home to a number of things, an opera house, a jewelry store, a drug store, a grocery store, the Naval Militia Armory, and the Commercial Club. It was, the stories say, also home to a plethora of ghosts. Augustine Root, the original owner of the Mercantile Building on Bell Street, was born in Montague, Massachusetts in December 1829. His father was a farmer and moved his young family to Vermont, where Augustine attended school. When he was only 20, he borrowed $40, packed up, and left home to pursue his fortune. His travels took him west, and he ended up in Alton in 1849. His first job was working as a clerk in the hardware store of Arba Nelson, and then for another hardware firm owned by the Topping Brothers. He saved his money and eventually started his own company with Anson B. Platt. During the Civil War, they sold hardware and stoves and made a fortune selling cattle to the military, but that business ended when Platt died. But Augustine had a nest egg, and while working in the farm implement business, he invested in real estate and railroads and became involved in banking in St. Louis and Alton. He was in business with prominent Alton man John Hayner for a time, invested in the Silgrow Iron Store, was vice president of the St. Louis National Bank, and director of the Alton Savings Bank. He became one of the richest men in town when he was only 30 years old. In 1865, he married Harriet Eaton, daughter of a well-known steamship owner, Captain Nathaniel Eaton, and they raised five children together. All the while, Augustine was still making money hand over fist, expanding his real estate holdings and constructing the Mercantile Building, which was home to offices, retail space, and what became the town's most sensational live theater. In 1882, Augustine, or more likely his wife, decided that Alton needed some culture, and he opened the Root Opera House in the Mercantile Building. Its second and third floors were converted into a theater with a large semicircle gallery. It was only the second entertainment spot to open in town. The other theater at that time was inside a city hall, and the only one to offer large capacity seating for many years. Thanks to this, the Opera House became the social center of Alton, and it hosted parties, plays, dances, and political rallies. John Mather managed it, a cousin of the famed architects, the Pfeifenberger brothers, who would go on to design the Temple Theater in 1891. And the opening of that new theater led to the closing of the Opera House a short time later. Other theaters followed, leaving the Root Opera House outdated and behind the times. But while it struggled through its final years of business, rumors spread that the theater was haunted. As almost anyone fascinated with hauntings can tell you, there's an adage that states that, quote, every good theater has a ghost. If true, then the Root Opera House was no exception. Customers, ushers, and staff members alike reported that strange sounds and unexplained footsteps were common in the theater at night. An opera house manager once reported that while making sure the auditorium was empty one night after a show, he encountered a woman sitting in one of the front seats near the orchestra pit. The grayish figure was sitting upright in the seat, looking straight ahead, as if watching something on the stage, even though the theater was dark, quiet, and otherwise empty. He could barely see the shape because the house lights were so dim, but he knew she was there. By the time he reached the front of the theater, though, the woman had vanished. Other apparitions were also spotted, sometimes by theater patrons. Several people claimed they'd seen blurry shapes in the rows of auditorium seats, while others folk of seeing them on the stairs or hearing footsteps coming down the steps toward them when there was no one there. The old stories continued to be told even after the theater closed, but a few years later, they were replaced by new ones. Augustine Root sold the building soon after the Opera House closed. He died in 1906 after being bedridden with a severe illness for more than 18 months. Henry McPike had purchased the mercantile building, and he had it divided into several stores, offices, and organizations, and at least one of those was vocal about its resident ghost. In 1896, the Alton Naval Militia rented out space in the McPike building. The unit had been mustered into service on February 1, 1896 by Captain D.C. Daggett from Moline, then commander of the 2nd Battalion. But even before that, a group of about 40 young men had banded together under the name of the Morrell Guards. They started holding regular drill meetings in the building. While this was happening, several prominent men, including Senator C.A. Erb, were trying to get the Guards an official place in the Naval Militia. Well, they succeeded a short time later and served during the Spanish-American War. Well, it was in November 1897 that one of the young men attached to the unit had a terrifying experience in the building, the same building where the haunted opera house had been. Dionysus Woods was a popular mascot of the Alton Naval Militia. As an African-American man, he was not allowed to join in those days, but he often accompanied the men on their outings, and he also ensured the hall was kept clean. The Naval Militia Hall was a familiar place to Woods. He'd been in the building countless times at all hours of the day and night and thought nothing of going in late in the evening to sweep the floors and empty the trash. Until the night when he swore he'd never go back into the place by himself again. Woods had picked up the keys and went over to clean the hall. He hadn't been gone long when he came hurrying back with the keys in his hand. He was frightened and visibly shaking and said that under no circumstances would he be going back to finish the job that night. He nervously explained that he had not been working long when his attention was grabbed by a shadow that passed by him. He turned around quickly and saw the shape of what seemed to be a man's head ducking out of sight around a corner. When it vanished, strange sounds followed. Weird shrieks, knocking, and laughter that seemed to be coming from under the stage. He also said that he saw a shovel that had been standing in the corner start to jump up and down, moving across the floor in his direction. If anything happened after that, Woods said he didn't see it because he'd already run out the door. Whatever happened that night in November 1897 was never explained. Woods was likable, loyal, and always truthful. The men from the unit had no reason to believe he'd made anything up, especially in light of the ghost stories that had been spreading about the building just a few years before. But years passed, and eventually the Alton Naval Militia followed in the footsteps of the Root Opera House and faded out of existence. Other spots took its place, like the Golding Jewelry Store, Thrifty Drug, Low Arts Grocery Store, the Commercial Club, and now Max Time Out Lounge. The last time ghosts were reported here was back in 1897, but that doesn't mean the place has no more stories to tell. Do those ghosts still walk on Bell Street? Maybe, or maybe not, but it is something worth wondering about the next time you happen to be there, sitting on a bar stool, drinking an ice-cold beer. The story of our other haunted drinking spot dates all the way back to Halloween of 1868. It wasn't a tavern back then, it was the First National Bank, located just steps away from the Mississippi River in downtown Alton. Now, I'm always the first to admit that the river was what built Alton and made it great. It brought wealth to town, but it also brought crime and criminals, which could often turn downtown Alton into a dangerous place. In the early morning hours of that October 31st, there were those out on the streets that night who were startled by cries of murder and gunshots. Witnesses saw a struggle between several men at the side door of the bank. Concerned citizens rushed to the scene and spotted three men fleeing toward the river. They also found a longtime night watchman named M.H. Filey lying on the street, near death. A single bullet had struck him in the heart. Burglars had apparently forced open the side door of the bank and had gotten inside. They pried open the iron doors of the vault, but hadn't been able to open the safe filled with cash that was inside of it. It was assumed that Filey had noticed something peculiar going on in the bank, probably the lights of the men trying to see to open the vault, and had gone around the side of the building to surprise them. Before he could reach the side door, he was spotted by one of the robbers who rushed outside and attacked him. Filey managed to overpower the man and force him to the ground, but the sounds of the struggle brought the other bandits outside. Several shots were fired, and one of the bullets hit Filey in the chest. The robbers fled in different directions. One of them was tracked quite some distance up Short Street using drops of blood, which suggested he'd been wounded, and another left an overcoat behind at the scene. The coat, though, held no clue as to the owner's identity. Filey, who never had the chance to remove his pistol from its holster, lived only 8 minutes after assistance arrived. He was never able to tell anyone exactly what had happened. His body was taken to the Franklin House, just two doors north of the bank, where a post-mortem examination showed that death had occurred from a bullet passing through his heart. He'd also been beaten in the head by some sort of metal bar, likely in the initial struggle. A coroner's jury later stated that his death had been caused by a person or persons unknown. And they remain unknown to this day because Filey's murder was never solved. The watchman's funeral was held on November 2nd. His body was laid out at his home on State Street, and he was honored as a member of the Odd Fellows. The services were attended by the mayor and city council, and the funeral was, in 1868, the largest ever held in Alton. But of course, that wasn't the end of the story. Filey's killers were still on the loose. Every effort was made to find them, but no solid clues were discovered. There had been a report of a fishing boat stolen from some folks on the riverbank, and police assumed the robbers had used it to escape. In addition to the overcoat that had been dropped in the street, two other coats were found at the edge of the river, along with a large carpet bag that contained a set of burglary tools. The bandits had not been able to break into the bank safe, but they had managed to clean out the cash drawers of all the coins that were on hand. A $1,000 reward was offered for the capture of the killers, but it was never claimed. Years passed, and the men who killed M.H. Filey were never found. But we can't say the same for some of the loot they made off with from the bank. In 1903, 35 years after the robbery, the Bluff Line Railroad was laying foundations for additional tracks along the river when one of the workmen made a startling discovery. When he shoved his spade down into the riverbank, he heard a metallic clink. He shoved aside the loose dirt and sand and uncovered the rotting remains of a cloth bag that contained dozens and dozens of old coins. They were mostly 1, 2, and 3 cent pieces, dated 1865. Some of the same coins reported missing after the robbery at the First National Bank. Some of the money from the robbery had been found, even if the men who had stolen it had not. Well, time passed and downtown Alton changed. By the early 1900s, Alton was no longer a thriving river port. Businesses moved and they changed too. The First National Bank moved to a new location a block away at 3rd and State Streets, and in the years that followed, the original building went through a series of owners to end up with the restaurant and pub that's located there today. In the first season of the podcast, we told you the story of the robbery and the haunting that took place in the years that followed at the home of M.H. Filey on State Street. But we didn't tell you about the ghost that still lingers at the site of what used to be the First National Bank, the place where Filey actually died. What I'll tell you first is that it's my favorite pub in town, not only for the food, but because it's the only place in Alton to get a proper Guinness pour. It's Morrison's Irish Pub. The pub opened back in 2015 and is a family-run labor of love, with a hand-built bar and tables, authentic Irish food, most of the ingredients for which are imported straight from Ireland and the UK, and, of course, a selection of Irish beers and whiskeys. It also has, according to many accounts, a resident ghost. Over the past few years, strange happenings have occurred at the pub. It's the usual stuff you might expect from a haunted place. Footsteps, unexplained sounds, flickering lights, you know the kind of thing I mean. But there's another unusual thing that occurs that you won't hear about with pretty much anywhere else in our haunted little town. It's a telltale sign that seems to link the resident ghost with the violent event that occurred in the building in 1868. The thing was, when it started happening, the owner who first noticed it had no idea what it meant. Above the pub is an apartment, which is pretty common in downtown Alton. Years ago, those spaces were often used for storage, additional space, and sometimes living quarters for those who owned the business below. And that hasn't changed much, including at Morrison's. But it was the occupants of that apartment who first started to notice the odd things. You see, those things appeared all over the place. So many, it couldn't be an accident, a coincidence, or someone leaving them behind as a joke. And what were those things? Pennies. Lots and lots of pennies. And they were always found face up. They were on the floor, on the table, on the shelves, in the kitchen. And then they started showing up downstairs too, on the bar, behind the bar, on chairs. They just kept popping up. Why? Well, that was what one of the owners wanted to know. Not only could she not figure out who was leaving the coins all over the place, she couldn't understand why they were leaving them or how they were doing it. The door to the apartment had been locked. No one else could get inside. The same could be said for the pub. The coins appeared in the morning after the place had been closed and locked up for the night. And yet, here were the pennies. This went on for weeks until finally one morning she spotted a penny that had appeared overnight. She knew it hadn't been there the previous evening because it was sitting on top of a book that she had been reading before bed. The book? Yep, Haunted Alton, which just happened to contain the story about the robbery, the death of M.H. Filey, his haunted house, and the discovery of those coins along the river, which had been left behind by the bandits. Suddenly, the coins started to make sense, and she decided there was no explanation for how and why the coins mysteriously appeared, other than a ghost was leaving them, that is.
Yeah.
Around a little bit.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
All right. Thanks for returning with us to Alton, Illinois for a special series of podcasts from American Hauntings. We're taking a trip back in time, sort of, to the first season of the show, which collected some of the most famous stories from one of the most haunted small towns in America. But it turns out we left out a lot of really good ones. So we're back in Alton for more. We've got old stories with updates and new stories that Troy managed to dig up for the new edition of his book, Haunted Alton. So buckle up. And by the way, I'm your co-host, Cody Beck. And with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Yep. With episode 6. So we're
episode 6.
Ready, man. To roll here. I know we're doing some new stuff, and it's been fun. I have to admit, I've had a good time doing this,
dude. I've learned so much.
It was one of those things where I ended up learning a lot of things that I didn't know the first time around, so it's been cool. I've really enjoyed it.
Hell yeah. It was something I was thinking about. I mean, there's a few different things obviously, but it's interesting to think about. I love Alton. I love the history. I like to know at least enough. I'm not history buff like you are or anything, but I like to at least know some things. But thinking about just like these places that I've been to, these sidewalks I've walked down, or these streets that I've been on, whether in traditional normal capacity or finding myself there by myself, you know, like in a crazy just that so much shit has happened. Like sometimes I might be walking down a spot where someone got murdered,
exactly.
Or like something crazy happened, and it's so interesting to hear these stories. It's bizarre. There's so much history.
That was the reason that we did this in the first place, is because you wanted to know.
So I wanted to know.
Here we are.
Okay. Well, then I need you to teach me something, and I might be just like kind of digging. Okay. What's the difference between an inn, a tavern, and a saloon?
Okay. So they used to call taverns. Okay. So an inn would be like a, compared to like a bed and breakfast.
Okay. Today, somewhere you could okay, stay. So,
yes. And a tavern would be the same type of thing in those days. Yes. There would probably be ale or something available. But mostly it was a place for you to stay and you could get food and drink.
Okay.
That was a tavern back in the day. Now we call taverns, you know, we call bars taverns.
It's kind of,
but after Prohibition, tavern became more known as something other than just, not a, a place where you would spend the night.
Okay.
But yeah. And then a saloon would, of course, would just be a place that you would come in to get a drink. So we'd call a bar today. But the confusion there is that the bar is the actual piece of furniture that is in the saloon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's, it just depends on how you want to use it. And when you write, I mean, I use tavern, saloon, and bar interchangeably because it stops it from being boring. So,
got it. Okay. You know. Yeah. So they were kind of distinct, but then it got a little muddied.
Right. It's over time, it has gotten muddy. But yeah, like in the early days of Alton, you know, taverns at that point would have been something that was kind of a three-way kind of thing where mm-hmm. you could get a drink, you'd get food, and it's someplace you could spend the night. It wouldn't necessarily be a hotel, which would be only for spending the night. It wouldn't be later they would start putting saloons into hotels. So yeah, it's
got it. Okay. Okay. So I'm right to be confused.
So stop before your head explodes. And
do you know at what point when they then adopted just bar as they placed?
Not really. I'm sure. I mean, it's probably something that could be looked up.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of hard to, I mean, it'd be something hard to Google, but
sure.
I probably got 20 books on, there's a great book on the history of American taverns called America Walked Into a Bar.
Oh, I love
it. It's a good book. It kind of is the history of how all that happened. So I couldn't tell you the date off the top of my head, but I'm sure you can find it in that book.
Well, yeah. So you said we're pretty much going to talk about two things today and some of Alton's favorite things, which are basically drinking and and ghosts. And I think that one of them might lead to me becoming the other one. There's, you taught me so many things. So Union Brewery, Killian Brothers Ale Brewery, Western Brewery, Cooper Brewery.
Yeah, we had a lot
Bluff
of breweries.
City. Bluff City. Yeah.
Bluff City. I mean, that's a name we all know. And that's probably the easiest one to find memorabilia from because it made it all the way past World War II, which nobody else did. So that was, an accomplishment right there. Most of that stuff got bought out early on. They get absorbed into other breweries and that kind of thing. So that's where a lot of them disappeared to. I mean, I go into a little bit deeper depth on some things I've written. I didn't think we needed a breakdown of every single brewery and distillery in Alton for this
episode. These are still nice new ones to know. Yeah,
I thought they were ones that we should know. The Alton Brewery and Bluff City. Those were the two big ones. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that lasted the longest. And Prohibition put the Alton Brewery out of business. It did not bounce back, kind of like the Lemp Brewery.
Yeah.
Bluff City allegedly sold Just Ice.
I'm sure they
allegedly
did.
During Prohibition.
Big swishy quotes.
But listen, Alton was not, Alton, as I mentioned here, Alton, Prohibition was about as successful in Alton as it was anywhere else.
Uh-huh.
Not very. Alton was not famous for speakeasies. And I mean, yes, every town had them. Every town had bootleggers. Every town. There's no town that I've ever run across that didn't have at least one speakeasy, even if it was some dude's basement.
Yeah.
And one bootlegger who was making his own beer in town and selling it or giving it to his friends. But Alton was not known for being this, the wettest town or in the area or anything. That's East St. Louis, man. I mean, East St. Louis was wide open during Prohibition.
It still kind of is.
Yeah. And well, it's different now, but then it was, it was speakeasies and liquor everywhere.
Yeah.
Alton was never like that. It just wasn't. I mean, we had a mayor and a police force that was actually making some effort They did lock, you know, they did close some things down. Nobody stayed in jail for long. Nobody took it very seriously in Alton, It was not famous. You know, it was not Little Chicago or anything like that. There were much more famous towns in this area known for bootlegging and speakeasies. It wasn't Alton. You know, we had good breweries. I mean, we did have good beer here in town. Apparently, I've never actually tasted.
Right.
I would not want it bottled from the late
1900s. No, hell no.
But I did appreciate the labels, and I did think it was worth mentioning that they did say that they bottled their beer or made their beer with Alton Lake water.
Yeah, what the hell is that?
That is the best.
Well, also, Troy, I will just say, like, if you took it, I will just be real. If you took both of us and put us at 25 years old back then, you and I would have been in some sketchy shit all that alcohol.
No, I we talked about that before. I guarantee I would have been in the bootlegging business. There was no way around it. I mean, you know, again, you're just giving people what they wanted. I mean, you don't have to kill everybody to do it.
Right.
I mean, you know, I doubt the competition would be all that bad in Alton, you know, so. Yeah, it'd probably be pretty easy. So
we would have figured out something. Yeah. But Bluff City, so Pearl in Union. From those of you not too familiar with Alton, I grew up a quarter of a mile from that intersection.
There's some buildings still there.
Oh yeah,
there are buildings. Yeah,
absolutely.
If you go by there, you'll find that it's still up on the stone. It still says the brewery on there.
Yes.
So yeah, there's still stuff around.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, if for anybody just want more context, that is exactly where I grew up. Alton. So Max Timeout. I wanted to ask you, what is, cause I know you've had shops and things like, but what is mercantile? What does it mean exactly? Oh, well,
he called it the mercantile building. It was mercantiles were just kind of like a small department store kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wouldn't call it a department store. But he called it a mercantile building because there were several other businesses in there and they were all selling some types of goods, dry goods, hardware, whatever. And so that's what he called it when he built it. And, you know, it was the root building. He called it the mercantile building. And part of it is still there. I mean, part of that building is still there. Next to Max, if you look up, the tall building is the old building.
Yeah.
There's just been a big portion of it that's been torn down. And then Max has kind of been... you can look at a blueprint a plat map of the street in the new edition of Haunted Alton. I put one in there so that people could see where Max sits now and where the building was. And so you get a better idea of exactly where it was. That whole big block there, which, you know, Max getting pretty close to owning the whole block.
But you know what?
There's still a few things. Yeah, good for him. But a lot of that was the footprint of the root building. And like I said, part of it is still there.
Yeah. And for people that don't know also, you will not get to see this, but Max also has a basement.
Yes. It has underground levels and And then there are lofts, in what's left of the root building.
So, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
The basement is terrifying.
Yeah. It's different.
Parts of it are.
Anyway, we don't have to get into all that.
It's a big spot. It's a busy spot, and it's got multiple bars and multiple rooms and, you know, brunch rooms and event rooms. It's a big place.
It is,
and you can see where it fit in where this big mercantile building was.
Absolutely. So. Augustine Root becomes one of the richest men in town at only 30 years old. So I feel like I've done nothing with my life.
Right.
But you see the building at one point had a theater and you know, an opera and everything. So this was probably a popping kind of spot.
Yeah, it was. It was. In 1882, we didn't have an opera house. We had one theater in town at the time, and it was in City Hall. It was the only one we had. And so I suggest it was his wife that convinced him we needed some culture, but opened the Root Opera House and he took the second and third floors of the building and converted it into a big semicircle theater. It was the largest seating in town at the time and for a long time until, you know, another opera house opened a few years later. When that one opened, then he kind of let this one close down because it was bigger and better kind of thing. And he really wasn't wanting to compete. He just opened it up because he felt like we needed something in town at the time. So that's how it got opened. And I'd love to tell you how the ghost stories got started, but I have absolutely no idea.
Sure.
I can't find any history that would explain why it was haunted. It was just one of those things where stories got started, and that's every theater though, pretty much.
Of course, yeah.
Any, you know, as we call them, legitimate theaters, as not a movie theater. That's how they used to refer to them, at least okay. In the early days when movie theaters and Nickelodeons first started, they were seedy, sordid, kind of like actors and actresses were back in the 19th century.
Right.
Movies came along, they were the, you know, the ugly stepchild to real theater. Mm-hmm. And so, especially an opera house, which again, that's one of those things like tavern, bar, and inn. Opera house did not mean that they performed opera there, women in big horned helmets performing Italian operas. They might have that there. But it was all kinds of entertainment. It was musical. It was singing. It might be actual opera, but it would also be plays and things too. It was It was more of a general theater.
Art thing, yeah.
Yeah. It was a general theater. But, you know, some of the stories, you know, stuck around. I mean, they don't seem to be, and they seem to have been, it's not like Augustine Root was wandering around because he loved this theater so much, which you often hear with haunted theaters.
Yeah.
He died after, you know, after he closed. I mean, after he closed the place, he sold it and then died a little while later. And then Henry McPike, owner of the McPike Mansion, bought the building, and he's the one who kept it going for a number of years after that.
Yeah.
And closed the opera house and started, you know, again, filling it up with other things.
Sure. Yeah. And that's something I did want to talk about, because I graduated with two of the McPikes, Jane and Christina. They're great. And I've learned a lot about McPike through them and through the podcast and everything. I was very curious about, like, how I said, like, yeah, you and I, 25, would have been doing some bootlegging shit, but like, but also like, what would it have been like to be a big fish in a small pond? Like, all
back to be then, a Hainer. Or a McPike, or Augustine Root, or Captain Sparks, or one of these guys, or a member of their family back at, you know, the turn of the last century,
the heyday, late 1800s,
early 1900s. Yeah. I don't know, man. They own so many things. You think of the McPike Mansion, everybody thinks of that, but they don't think about like the old Cracker Factory downtown. Henry McPike owned that. He owned tons of real estate, or the Lures brothers that own the Mineral Springs. And we'll get to that in our last episode of this, you know, revisit. But I mean, these guys own so much property and so many things in town. I can't imagine what that must have been like. It's just and then, like you said though, big fish in a small place, but they certainly were, you know.
Would have been awesome. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about, that let's jump to the First National Bank. M.H. Filey lying dead in the street.
We talked about that in our original season, in our haunted house section.
He is not the man with the steps and that was kidnapped and all that sort of stuff.
No.
Okay.
No.
Good.
This is the guy who was the night watchman. He had a house up on State Street, and there were footsteps and things in the house. Remember, it was a girl who had sent in given that story to a friend of mine, who sent it on to me. Mm-hmm. And then we used it in the very first season in our haunted house section. But that's the same guy. So that house where he lived was said to be haunted, but so was the place where he died. But I'm not convinced that the ghost that haunts the location now is him. Uh-huh. I think it might be one of the guys now trying to repay what they did.
Right.
So that's my thought.
Because 35 years later, a railroad worker finds a bag of coins.
Mm-hmm. One of them, because there were a lot. They had several.
I guess you got to cut losses, but like, wouldn't you come back for some of them?
Well, I don't know. It's 1868. Well, they didn't. It wasn't all the coins they took. It was just one of the bags must have gotten dropped, and they needed to escape because they had just murdered someone.
Which they
didn't plan on doing. I don't think
never
they
starts
planned
out
to
that
kill
way.
Him, you know, because he's the one who, you know, he came after them and kind of upped the violence in the whole thing. Uh-huh. And the guy went out to confront him, but I think he would have been happy to just knock him out and they could have taken off. But, you know, guns came out and, you know, things got really ugly. I'm not blaming him for his death. I'm just saying. And in 1868, a bag of coins, even 1, 2, and 3 cent pieces, would have added up to a decent amount of money when you're taking all the coins out of the till and taking off with it. I mean, they didn't get any of the bills because they were all locked up in the safe.
Great bank robbers.
They couldn't. Yeah. They're terrible bank robbers. Obviously, you know, no bank robber wants to leave bodies behind. You know, that's how you end up hanged instead of just locked up for a couple of months.
That's the thing now too, though. It's like, if you kill someone during the commission of a crime, all are fucked.
Yeah. And so nobody wanted that, but yeah. So I'm guessing they probably, in their haste to get away, one of them lost the bag, you know, with the coins in it. And then when they were digging up for the railroad bed for the new lines, they
found
the coins, and they're like, oh, okay, well, here's some of them. So at least we know they went this way, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that was what they figured out.
And yeah, occupants above that supported area, they would report weird things, like a ton of pennies would appear always face up.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about too, because I don't know if I've told you about this, but someone told me after my father passed away April of 2022, mm-hmm. and somebody had told me about loved ones will often leave you dimes, and I was like, that sounds weird, but I looked into it.
Stuff
I was
like that too.
But I was like, oh, this isn't something that they just made up. I was like, this is like a.
It's a thing. Yeah, it's a thing.
And so nowadays I collect any dime that I ever randomly find.
Oh yeah.
And I put it in this jar right next to his picture. And my buddy actually got me a thing from Target, and it says dad jokes loading. It has a loading bar. And he's like, I figured you could put your dimes in it. And I was like, that's amazing. So I put all the dimes that I find in there. Who fucking knows if I don't know anything, but worst case scenario, if I fill it up, eventually I'll have $200.
And this was just funny because it's Morrison's, and so I love Morrison's anyway. Yeah. But then I heard this story from one of the owners, and mm-hmm. She was telling me about, and had no idea, didn't know anything about, knew nothing.
No shit.
Didn't know about about the coins, the robbery, nothing. And these pennies just started showing up everywhere, all over the house and in the bar. And now things still happen. They happen in the bar and upstairs in that building.
If you're in Morrison's and you find pennies, let us know.
Yeah. But she finds a penny and she knew it wasn't there, and it's sitting on top of a copy of Haunted Alton that then has the story of the Filey house and the robbery in it. You know, and it's like, oh my God. I mean, that's how I heard the story, you know. So yeah, and it's funny.
Why is it I love that kind of stuff, a penny face up on a copy of Haunted Alton or whatever, but what is it that it has to be that kind of shit as opposed to just a ghost coming out of you and just being like, yo?
I know, right? Wouldn't it just be easier if they just show up and go, hey, listen, I did something.
Yeah,
it was 1868. Right? I was stupid. You know, I got involved in this robbery. It was the other guy's fault. And the gun, I accidentally killed this guy. And so I'm feeling really bad about it. So I'm trying to make up for it here. So I'm just going to kind of start dropping off money here and there when I've got it, you know, a little extra to spare. I'm going to leave some laying around. And so you'll know it's me. If you find something, you'll know it's me.
Is it?
And then he could just go on his way, and then he can just drop off pennies when he feels like it. I don't know. It's a good
thing.
Maybe it just takes too much effort.
Well, has to be ghost rules and regulations or something we just don't know about.
Remember in the Ghost, that Patrick Swayze movie? Remember when the guy was teaching him how to make the cans move in the subway.
I remember the penny.
Oh yeah, yeah. So you know, maybe there's just some kind of rule and this guy just doesn't have the hang of it. Obviously not a genius. I mean, you know, we've already figured that out maybe that's all it is.
Yeah,
I just can't quite figure it out.
Yeah, I'll speak ill of the dead when you're a criminal like that. I've told people before, I'm like, people are like, oh, you know, if I die, I'll send a butterfly or you'll see this, whatever. And I'm like, you know what? No, here's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to send a flamingo. Because if you see a flamingo in St. Louis.
Yeah, you're going to know.
You're going to know. Yeah. I'm not going to leave anything up to chance. If you see a flamingo, it'll be me. Oh, man. Well, dude, yeah. Thank you again. I love learning more about Alton and just in especially places I've been so many times and walking around and just thinking, and now just knowing something crazy happened here, tragic. I think there's a lot of things, think about the things that we're so happy that we don't like probably engagements or people falling in love or meeting for the first time. And all. Many strong emotions in these places that I don't think twice about. Cause I wouldn't know, but it's nice to think about, but yeah, but hey man, that's all I got.
All right, cool. So, all right, well, I guess we'll wrap it up. If you guys are listening to this and maybe you don't listen to our regular show, I don't know why you wouldn't, but maybe you don't, but if you would like another show from us, we do have our Patreon podcast that we do. We're in the middle, I'm not even gonna say we're in the middle, we're somewhere in the season about H.H. Holmes, which has been a pretty popular season for us, and you can check it out. You can just learn more about it if you want to at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. You can use our promo code for the podcast. It's just the word podcast. When you're doing any shopping at AmericanHauntings.net or at AmericanHauntingsClothing.com, it's 10% off. We're just giving things away pretty much. Anyway, check out anything we got going on. We've always got stuff going on in Alton. dinnerandspirits.com. That's all of our dinner tours. AltonHauntings.com. That's all of our local tours. So check those out. And we'll see you next time. We have a few more episodes to go.
And we've said this before, but it is not an October thing. It is all year round. If you want events and spooky shit, all year round.
Yep.
So this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written by Troy Taylor and is produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. We hope you've enjoyed this Return to Alton podcast and will be with us as we present 10 episodes of the history, hauntings, legends, and lore from one of the most haunted small towns in America. Thanks for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.